to Aegetius, thrice consul, the groans of the Britons, the barbarians drive us to the sea, the sea drives us to the barbarians. Between these two means of death, we are either killed or drowned. What a fright I got because of it. Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of The Jolly Heretic. Now, today, I would like to talk about South Africa. Specifically, I would like to talk about... we talked about in the last video about the future of the West in terms of Argentina, and we've talked about it in terms of Venezuela. And now I'd like to go in much more detail about once the collapse really gets underway, what the future would be like, what the beginnings of a Neo-Byzantium would be like once we collapse due to declining intelligence, due to polarization, due to all of the other factors that I've looked at in other videos as to why inevitably we are entering the winter of civilization and the collapse will occur. Now, we are no further ahead anywhere in this regard, perhaps, than in terms of South Africa. Before I look into what's going on in South Africa, I would like to look into what happened when Britain collapsed. So in around the year 410, Britain, which was ruled by the Romans had set up civitas, that is to say, administrations all over Britain. They had Romanized the Britons, such that you have the Romano-British class that had that spoke in Latin, that had a Roman way of life, that lived in places like Bath and St. Albans and all of these kinds of places that had beautiful mosaic floors and all of these Roman villas. You had all of this sort of thing. You had this entire Roman infrastructure. You had areas of what were called Britain that were not properly ruled by the Romans, in particular in the far east of Britain, in East Anglia. Areas that were not really under their control, that were constantly rebelling to the extent that they weren't even fully Christianized by the time the Romans left. But for the most part, Britain was Christianized and was Romanized, and their hold on Western Britain, that is to say Wales, Cornwall, anything west of Bristol, was much stronger than was their hold on Eastern Britain. But even so, all of this stuff was created. There was an entire infrastructure of magistrates and all of this that was set up by the Romans. The Romans then withdrew in about 410, and in 411 they basically declared that the Britons should go it themselves. They weren't going to help. That a result of that was a power vacuum. All of the people who had relied on helping these Romans out, on working for these Romans, on doing what these Romans wanted to get done, all of their jobs were gone. And the economy of Britain collapsed. It collapsed very quickly into poverty. The cities collapsed into chaos. The cities, which to a great extent sort of furnishing the Roman army and Roman people, collapsed. People withdrew from the cities. There was a scramble for the countryside. People started cannibalizing the cities in order to get resources they needed. Trade links were broken. There wasn't enough iron. People stopped putting nails on their boots so they'd slip over and things like this. The standard of pottery collapses. Glass making. So all of this stuff that was reliant on the presence of Romans goes, and the economy falls into a much simpler way of doing things, because all of these people whose jobs sword makers, all of these kinds of people whose entire profession was based around the presence of a large standing Roman society, all of those people suddenly found themselves unemployed, and suddenly there was a scramble for land. At the same time, and a movement back to a simpler way of life. We know this from the archaeology. At the same time, you have Saxons entering the country from the east and setting up settlements. Sometimes they would fight with the local Britons for territory, but a lot of the time they just sort of rubbed along and integrated, and the daughters of the British ended up marrying the Saxons, and the children became Saxon, and so gradually gradually Saxon influence starts to expand, therefore pagan influence starts to expand. You get the usual process whereby Britons notice that there's more Britons in the west of the country, and then they start emigrating towards the west of the country. Britain in the west has stayed in contact with the Roman Empire. They're no longer being assisted by it. There's no military presence, but it has stayed in contact through trade routes, and so it is in contact with Constantinople. The east of the country is increasingly Anglo-Saxon and is not in contact with Constantinople. But it degenerates into chaos where nobody is really in charge. The structures, the civitas that were set up in the west of the country are not as clear-cut in the east. They're not as well established. And so you have a power vacuum in which there is no law and order in a context of high unemployment and all of this sort of thing. And so the result of that, of course, is protection rackets, is people establishing themselves as the de facto government of these areas. Nowhere is this clearer than in London, in Londinium. So although the Romans withdrew in 410, or out of Roman authority withdrew in 410, even by the end of the 5th century, there is evidence that London itself, the city of London, was still Roman. And when I say it was still Roman, I mean it was Romano-British people who had taken on Roman culture, managing to live a Roman lifestyle via running essentially a protection racket, and thus at great expense managing to get in the wine and whatever else they needed from the Roman Empire proper, from the mainland Roman Empire, and thus continuing to live a Roman lifestyle while all around them was encroachments of Anglo-Saxons and all of this sort of stuff. And as long as they had the sufficient financial resources, as long as they had sufficient land that they controlled, where they that could be farmed, and people started farming within the city, by the way, as long as they had enough money and resources, they could maintain this, and they maintained a protection racket, whereby people paid them for protection, and using this money, they were able to live for a very long, until the end of the 5th century, a Roman lifestyle within the city of London. Then London was lost. I mean, then they died out and whatever. London was completely abandoned. And then we saw, even at the end of the following century, so at the end of the 6th century, only then does St Albans fall. So St Albans was a Romano-British town in which a Roman lifestyle was still lived right up till that time, and this was done through, of course, successfully creating a protection racket. What you really had in the absence of a proper society was the degeneration of post-Romano Britain into a series of very small protection rackets, because that's what societies ultimately are. They're protection rackets. You pay money to the person in charge of the protection racket, the very genteel person, the king or whatever, and in return you receive protection from that person. Or you don't pay them money, but if he could ask you to go and fight in one of his wars occasionally for the good of the group, then you do so. That is the social contract of the protection racket, in essence. And that is what all societies until relatively recently have been based around. If you look at Britain or England, even in the 16th century, it was a series of protection rackets whereby you as a farmer, your land would be protected from other people that might invade it. No police force, remember. It would be protected in return for you fighting in the protection racket of your lord against another protection racket. That was the essence of everything, protection rackets. There are parts of, let's say, Northern Ireland now, such as parts of Londonderry, that are not really under the control of the British police, where the British, certainly in the 70s that was the case, the British police would not venture into the Catholic parts of Londonderry. They weren't controlled by the British state. They were controlled by the IRA, which was basically a protection racket, that ensured law and order and so on, and kneecapped people that broke the rules. It was vigilantes. But these are basically nascent states. Now, this is what we have in South Africa, and it's extremely interesting, and I put a link to a video about it below. South Africa has now fallen apart. South Africa In large swathes of the country are no longer under control of the government. There is no law and order. To the extent there is law and order, it is corrupt. You can't rely on it. Nature abhors a vacuum. And the result of that is that de facto states are basically being set up within South Africa. At the moment in South Africa, there are roughly 94,000 sworn-in police officers in the whole of South Africa, which means that there are, by the way, 345 police officers per 100,000 of population, which is quite a lot, because if you consider them, it's a crime-ridden country, so they have to have quite a lot of police officers. In Finland, a country with a very low crime rate, there are 134 police officers per 100,000. Why? Well, you don't need many police officers in Finland, because people are all relatively similar to each other, and people, for various reasons that we're not allowed to talk about, do not commit that much crime. But in South Africa, there are 2.4 million people working as security guards in basically protection rackets, working as private security. It is the biggest growth industry you could possibly see. Now, but it's more than that. It's more than just what do they actually do. They're not simply people that you hire to stand outside your property or whatever. They're actually acting now in the manner of a state. So there was a very interesting interview I saw, I'll give a link to it, where they do think, I mean, these operations, they gather intelligence. They go to the area that they're supposed to protect, and they do little investigations, and they try and preempt where and why crime is going to happen to their clients, such that crime can be avoided. They put in preventative measures in much the same way. They have squadrons of drones which will fly around areas spying on those whom they think might well be criminals in order to preempt what they're going to do and to ensure that those things do not occur. They have huge levels of technology. They have all kinds of artificial technology, everything fed into a computer, again, so they can work out where crime might occur, why crime might occur, who might do it, and how best they can protect their clients. Then they can, of course, get in touch with their clients and tell their clients what to do. They have night vision drones, so they can send these drones around at night and spy on the populace of the area surrounding essentially a gated community. We can think of sub-Romano London as a kind of gated community that was protected from the barbarians, whether we're talking about poor Britons or whether we're talking about Saxons, at the gate, who were competing for resources and competing for land and competing for useful materials and all of this sort of thing. It's a gated community that was protected, and it was protected through this system of a protection racket. And that's what you have now in many areas of South Africa, particularly white areas of South Africa. You in effect have gated communities of the kind we were talking about last week in Argentina, that's where everything is done to ensure that they can live in effect a Western lifestyle within the gates of their community. And they are able to do that because they pay these protection rackets, basically, these security firms, to ensure that the enemy cannot get into their property. Now, there's you have tactical teams that are on call all the time that can be sent out if there is any kind of, if the drones or whatever indicate the beginning of any kind of disorder in the neighbourhood. Of course, the houses, if you live somewhere like this, are fortresses. Of course you have a burglar alarm. Of course you have various different alarms. Of course you have weapons in your property. Of course you have everything that wouldn't occur to a lot of people. They are like medieval castles, these houses in South Africa, that need to be protected. Of course you're told to check your alarm all the time. Of course you and so on. You have vigilantes that will surround shops that will ensure that shops don't get destroyed. People drive up to shops with vans with the purpose of robbing shops. So you have private security surrounding shops. You're told to be careful where to park. If you park near one of these vans, they might steal your car. So in broad daylight. So of course you don't do that. You have hijacking in broad daylight. So you have CCTV everywhere being monitored by these security companies. You have electric fences all over the place to protect property and all of this sort of thing. Of course, people drive large vehicles because it's more difficult to hijack those. Very, very high walls, basically Fort Knox, in order to ensure that you are protected. And so these security organisations, they go much, much, much further than what you might think would happen in a Western country, than simply protecting the place here and now. They preempt crime, they gather information, they gather data, they spy on individuals, they spy on groups, they gather all kinds of information in order to best protect their clients. So what you really have is the beginnings in parts of South Africa of a de facto state. You have a country that is so lawless where you cannot rely on the police, where, as was seen in the riots in Durban in the summer, the police are themselves corrupt and are engaging in rioting. So the police are meaningless. The police, you can't call the police. You can't call on the police. And they won't do. And if these security companies commit violence, well, there's so little law and order in parts of South Africa that probably nothing will be done about it anyway. And they're only committing it against other criminals. So what you end up with is the beginnings of a state, a nascent state. And people talk about this about how in South Africa, oh, there's this Oriana or whatever, there's wannabe separate states. That's entirely true. But what you have this everywhere, all over the place, little dots of separate states, which basically are beyond the law and where there are certain people, we don't know who they are, but they're the people who are in charge of the, well, perhaps we do know who they are, as you'll see in the video, that are in charge of these protection rackets, basically, these security companies, and they are, in essence, the people that are in charge of these micro-states within South Africa. And now, I mean, within South Africa, you have two little countries. Swaziland is one of these. Lesotho is the other. Now, why are they able to be two little countries? It's because historically you have what is a de facto protection racket, where people are loyal to the leader of that protection racket. He protects them in return for service. And so they see themselves as his followers, and they are prepared to accept that, no, he should be in charge of them, and they're loyal to him. And that's his area. That's his patch. That's all these nations are. And so with the breakdown of large, complex nations during the winter of civilization, what you end up with, and what definitely happened in Britain, was the rise of small polities, very small polities. I mean, we're talking the size of towns or the size of a few villages that were based around who is able to protect the people, who has the intelligence and the wit and the planning and the ability to protect the people within his area, within his remit, and thus extract resources from them such that he can live and concentrate on doing his protection work while everybody else does the necessities of life, farming and blacksmithing and everything else. And even if that happens within the context of a broader de jure state, such as the state of England, it doesn't really matter. I've written a book on this on 16th century Cheshire, called The Ruler of Cheshire. 16th century Cheshire was not under the control of the crown. The person that was ruling Cheshire could basically do what he liked, and did do what he liked. He would have people executed without reference to the crown, without reference to the king. He could do what he liked, and he did do what he liked. And it was the same with regard to parts of Wales. There was someone called William Brereton who was executed for adultery with Anne Boleyn. He could do what he liked, and he did do what he liked. And occasionally, it got him in conflict with the broader protection racket that was England. But for the most part, the people of Cheshire, the rulers of Cheshire, were just left alone to do what they liked. And I think that this is increasingly what's going to happen in South Africa. So what you will see in the video that I link below is basically a warlord, a very genteel warlord, a very intelligent warlord, but a person. But we could compare it to Afghanistan, to the lawless areas there or whatever. A person who is basically in charge of a de facto mini state within South Africa. That's what he is. And that is what the future will be for civilization. Little enclaves, little Romano-British enclaves, where Western society is kept alive in exactly this way. Through the beginnings of a state, with intelligence gathering and spies and everything else that you would expect a state to have. That is what you now have in parts of South Africa. Okay, well, I hope this is a bit of interest, and if it has, then please subscribe. It really helps me if you do that. Please look in the box below if you want to support the video, support the channel, and I will see you soon, and goodbye, and be donkey.